Session number 14806.
Mr. Eddie Murray, side 25. So, we're talking about what other things that you were doing.
On one occasion in 19. This is before I went on protection with Churchill, which was 1950. Prior to that, so it must have been Christmas, New Year's Eve in 1949. I 48 or 49, I believe it was 49, when, to give the protection officer of Bevin, who was the foreign secretary at that time, living in Carlton Place, to give him, I suppose, a holiday, they called me in and said, you're going on protection duties tonight at number Carlton Terrace, Mr. Bevin. And he wasn't even in the blooming building. That's the funny thing. So I remember it happening, and one of the blokes from admin, from the office, do you see, was in there. And Frankie Bridges was the officer, the superintendent on personnel. And he was there, and he said, you're going on protection, do you see, in Carlton Terrace. Do you know where it is? And I said, yes, I know where it is. I know where the foreign secretary lives. Right, he said, that's where it is. And so he says, you'll get there at... whatever, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. And so the admin lad said, well, shall I issue you a revolver? And so I remember Frankie Bridges sitting there blandly saying, no bloody gun, he said. No, you can take your truncheon. That'll do for tonight. He said, it'll only be for tonight. So, you know, what was I to say? And so that evening, I went along to Carlton Terrace, you know, and went downstairs into the basement, which was the usual room, and I wasn't told where Bevin, the foreign secretary, was at all. And I wasn't given much instruction. I was told just to stay there, and if anything untoward happened, that there was the phone, and I was to get in touch with the reserve room, you know, who would take steps to get everything organized.
So the reserve room was what, the coordinating point for a special branch of the protection officers?
Right? No, for every... That was the reserve room for the special branch. Any incoming calls went to the reserve room. You see, and it was on night and day. There was a 24-hour service there.
What sort of response would they at that time have been able to give?
Oh, well... there would be an inspector on duty as well, most of the time, and he would be aware of procedure as far as protection was concerned. And there are several stories about this protection lock, about the reserve room lock. For instance, Comdon. The name like that.
This is the...
Sir... Peter...
Imber.
Yes, Imber. You know, he used to be one of my PCs when I used to do reserve duty.
Right.
In the reserve room.
Right.
You know, sometimes night duty, because to get away from protection occasionally, if the old man was in bed, for instance, and not going to move, you know, for 3 or 4 days, I would suggest that, as there was always uniformed policemen outside number 28 Hyde Park Gate in Kensington, and frequent patrol car passing through and checking, that it was stupid of me me to stay there.
Yeah.
And so couldn't I do reserve duties?
Yes.
And yes, they were delighted, you see, that I would do reserve duties, and I knew my way about, and I was, though I say it myself, very, very efficient, much more efficient than the majority of special branch officers who took it as a more or less an insult, really,
to be on reserve,
you see. And but I knew it, I practically knew it all, especially when Peter Imbert was there. I mean, there's the proof. He became commissioner. But he's failed to recognize me. And so reserve duties were there. Mm-hmm. And there was I on... So that was the first time I went on protection. Mm. And that was just overnight. On the Labour Foreign Secretary, who was admired immensely by Churchill, I must say. Really? Churchill thought the world of Bevin. Bevin, not Nye Bevan.
No.
That's another story. Yes. But and I remember Churchill unveiling the bust in the Foreign Office.
Oh, really?
To Mr. Bevin.
Right. Well, look, we've now coming up to the. You were posted to be Churchill's bodyguard.
Yes, in the year 1950.
How did that happen?
I was just on duty in Special Branch, doing what Special Branch officers do, you know, interrogating people and putting in reports that inevitably came back, you know, with one or two words that had to be changed.
Mm. Did you run sources in Special Branch?
Informers, you mean? Mm. Yes, we had informers. Mm. And we used to pay, and that was one of... So I said...
Within these organisations?
In these organisations, yeah. Yes. Or hangers-on, if you like,
yes.
Who were not actually members, but were known by the organisers, you know, to be dithering, if you like.
Yes.
Or to be out of jobs and had nothing else to do, and they wanted a warm place to put their feet up or something like this. And so they went to the meetings, and they became known. And so... Yes, some of them became informers, quite a lot of them.
Full-time informers or part-time?
When they had something to tell us, you know, they would get in touch with us.
Yeah.
And we'd make an appointment at a
club. It was like a bit of a part-time job for them.
I mean, it was a part-time job, yes. And some of them, of course, were much more responsible. Mm. Quite a lot of responsible people who could inform... on other matters, like, you know, suspected people that with whom they'd come in contact in business dealings, for instance, and they'd say, well, you know, this bloke appears to have quite a lot of money, and yet he's come from a very poor Scandinavian background or Russian background, and he seems to have a lot of money and he wants to get into my business, you know. And then we'd tell them to learn as much about him as possible.
And how would they get in touch with you?
Oh, they would phone us up. We'd give them, yes. Or they would, you know, very often we had quick lunches, and so we'd go to one of two pubs, either one right outside the gates, or the other one, which is a little bit further up the road towards Parliament there. One of the local pubs, and they'd come to these local pubs, you know, and see somebody they recognised or ask about.
The Red Lion and the White Shoe.
Red, yes.
Yeah. Well,
you know.
One knows and pubs. So,
and so I couldn't remember the name. I didn't frequent them very much. No. You know, being on protection of Churchill put me almost outside of that.
Yeah. What about in trade unions and so forth? Do you have any people in?
Well, they must have. I'm sure. They did.
How much were you directed by MI5 Box at that time?
Yes, MI5 were a very powerful unit as far as Special Branch were concerned, but on the other hand, the Special Branch was not run by MI5, and the. It depended upon the governor, really, how much information we fed to MI5. There's a lot of information. For instance, on one occasion, as I'm going up the front steps to go to the reserve room to see if there were any messengers, and I was on protection then, Evan Jones, who is now dead, who was the chief of the special branch at the time, chief superintendent. No, he was deputy commander. Maybe commander, coming down the front steps and passed me and he said, Superintendent Bridges wants to see you. So I said, oh, well, I hope it's important because I'm in a hurry. Churchill's going out, you know. He said, better go and see him. So I said, okay. So I went in to see Frankie Bridges, superintendent. Oh, he said, sit down, I've got a report for you to make. And so I said, report? You know, is it on Churchill? Because if it's not, then, you know, it'll have to wait, because he's going out shortly, in half an hour's time, and I have to get there. No, sit down. You'll see in a minute what it's for. So at the time, I was the chairman of an organization that we'd set up, two of us had set up, and we had quite a number of adherents, and this was the Foreign Legion Association. And this bloke had got in touch with me. He was a civil servant, Yeovil. And he got in touch with me because of when I was at Peel House, I'd been on the radio, in the World and His Wife, for 15 minutes. And the superintendent at Peel House had even put a notice on the board saying that PC Murray was giving was speaking on the radio that evening at 6:15 on the World and His Wife. And he hoped that the majority of us would try and listen, and we wished him the very best of luck, you see, and all this sort of thing. And so it got into the newspapers, and there was an article in the newspapers about me and the Foreign Legion and how I'd got out.
This is when you're Churchill's bodyguard?
No, this is before.
Okay, right.
It's just because it's informative. Yeovil got in touch with me and we formed this organization. And so here I am, the chairman, and he's the secretary, and we had meetings two or three times a year in Praed Street. And we used to have big sandwiches, lots of sandwiches. In his place, he was living with a girl, several girls occasionally. And opposite was another pub, and we used to go across there for the red wine. Sometimes he would have stock in, you see, but we'd always finish up in this pub in Praed Street opposite. Edgware Road it is, not Praed Street.
Right.
Edgware Road just before the junction with Praed Street. And so we used to enjoy these meetings together, do you see? So Frankie Bridger said, have a look at that. And he handed me, this is when I was on protection, and so he handed me this folder, and on the front in big letters, Edmund Murray. So I said, oh, here's one for the books. He said, well, look inside. And so I looked inside, and here's the usual letter, request for information from MI5. And it said, it has come to our knowledge that a certain Edmund Murray one time French Foreign Legionnaire is now the chairman of an organization called the Foreign Legion Association, and members of this organization come from various countries of the world, and it's a well-known fact that people, foreigners go into the Foreign Legion. And could they, what they envisaged, could they have as much information as possible upon the reputed chairman of the Foreign Legion Association? See, in view of the fact that there were lots of foreigners come to our meetings, that I might be able to extract information and get important information, or, et cetera, et cetera, or even find members that could come into the MI5. They didn't tell us that. So Frankie looked at me and he said, well, what do you think of that? Now, here am I, a police officer. This is after 1950. Mm. This is 52 or something like this, maybe 53. So here, I've been a copper for nearly 10 years, and in official lists and all the rest of it, and MI5 are still unaware
of
it.
Can't even put two and two together. Yeah.
So I put in a lovely report, two-page report, two full-scale report, about it, you see, saying, yes, I was, and here I've been in the police force for 10 years, I've been in special round for such and such a time, and I put in a two-page report which pleased this anti-Murray superintendent Bridges, Frankie Bridges, very, very much indeed. But it just shows you the cooperation that existed between MI5 and Special Branch. There were things which could have been, I suppose, were important in the protection of the Queen or, in the nation's interest, national interest, that there was great cooperation between the two of us. But there were lots and lots of things that MI5 knew which they did not divulge, even although it could be relevant to Special Branch and vice versa.
Did you form a particular opinion of them, the sort of people that were in MI5?
I met up with occasionally, but they were, according to them, do you see, the intelligence, the secret service of the nation, and we were just the, the additives, if you like. That they were there because they were really necessary, and we were there to help them and be dog's bodies. which I'm afraid occasionally we were.
Didn't they run their own people doing...
oh, yes, they did. They did exactly the same as us.
Yes.
You know, the surveillance and all that sort of thing. And I'm sure that occasionally, or quite often, they would have their bloke at the same meeting that we were at. And
but not wearing police boots.
But all the demands for naturalisation went through MI5, and they transmitted them to us. And so they'd have a good peep at them, to see, oh, well, this one's going to be very interesting, you know. And they could see that there were possibilities of advancement in or promotion or something like that, perhaps, you know, if they carried out an investigation on such and such a person.
Yes.
But, and so the other stuff was sent across to the branch.
You felt they were rather sort of aloof, did you?
They were an autocratic lot, yes. Yeah. And they felt that they were really the... what can I say? You know, the dog's bodies,
the bee's knees.
The bee's knees, yes. They were, yes.
Mm. And what, they're all sort of...
And some of them were nice blokes, really.
Ah, okay.
You know, I met up with them.
But, are they okay, yeah. But I mean, they're all sort of Oxbridge backgrounds and so forth, are they? Or
the majority of
the
them.
The majority, yes. And not service, or had they any service
blokes? Oh, yes, there were quite a lot of service blokes.
At that time?
Yes, yeah. At that time there were a lot of service blokes.
Yeah. Right.
And
not many women.
Lots of RAF blokes, for instance.
Really?
Yeah. And quite a lot of senior officers, as a matter of fact, over and above the rank of captain.
Right.
Quite a lot of them. And they didn't have important positions, not all of them.
No.
Several of them have got on, you see, with their, you know, army titles and things like this.
And did they... they didn't have many women there at that time?
Not in that time. I think we only had two women in Special Branch.
And in the security service?
And in the security service, they just... Well, there were very few, I know for a fact.
Okay. Yeah. Did you get through the door to see them, or did they always come and see you?
Oh, no. No, always outside meetings.
Right. Okay.
They didn't even come to Special Branch. Always pub.
Really?
Pub crawls again, yes.
Okay. Shall we go on to Churchill? we were going on to Churchill until I distracted myself. So, was it announced that you
were being... Oh, yes, it was. So, there was I in the Special Branch, armed with, you know, three or four languages, and a reasonable knowledge of the political parties that we had in England, and a knowledge of all the other things that Special Branch usually do. As I said, you know, port surveillance, and... one night protection, and all these meetings and things, and reserve duties. And so I knew where the incident room was, I knew where the back hall was, where all visitors to Scotland Yard went, and I knew where the CRO was, Criminal Records Office, and I knew where the passport office was, and the Bush House for companies, tracing companies, to whom some of the requests for naturalisation, these people, you know, for company directors and all that sort of thing. And so they had to be declared at Bush House. And if they weren't, then there was something fishy about them.
Of course.
And so all this information we had to get to. And then, of course, in the Somerset House, we were aware of the possibilities of Somerset House as far as tracing where people were born and who their parents were and this sort of thing, before it was transferred down to Kew Gardens under. But... So I knew, you know, I was a Special Branch officer par excellence, if you like, because I took to it like a duck to water. And then suddenly I was called in the month of August, the beginning of the first week in August in 1950, called in again to this Frankie Bridges bloke who, you know, was head of detail, detailing officers to different jobs. And... he told me that if I had any reports outstanding, I had to get them in as quickly as possible, because the following week I was going on protection Winston Churchill.
Right. What did you think about that?
Well, you know, I was a bit overwhelmed by it.
And what age were you at that time?
That was 50. 1950, and so I was 33.
Right.
See, quite a young bloke, really. But of course, I knew all about arms and ammunition, and I was an excellent shot, and I had proven myself in the police force by being a member of the Bisley,
the
Bisley team, championship team, do you see? And the
pistol and rifle, or
pistol only.
Really?
Pistol only. And the strangest thing was that occasionally we used to get permission from the city police to go along to their headquarters in Snow Hill to use their firing range. But we couldn't use it every day or every week or every month.
Mm.
We had to depend upon the availability. Otherwise, we had to go down right down to Wimber Court.
Really?
Do you see?
They had no other
There was no shooting range at all in Scotland Yard. Which
or any of the other stations?
Oh, none of the stations. No, no, no. So it seemed a bit farcical, really. And I don't know about now. They probably have one in the new building. But still, so, you know, I had proven that I was an excellent shot.
Mm.
One of the half dozen best
yes.
in the whole of the Metropolitan
right.
Police Force. And so there was that which was going for me, I suppose. And so, you know, I got in these reports. And the following week I went down in a police car from Lambeth down to Chartwell.
Mm.
There was always a police car. I think it was misused most of the time, but it was Churchill, and I think he was entitled and accorded certain privileges. For instance, he had two special branch officers on protection in those days. Even while he was in opposition.
Mm.
And then again when he became Prime Minister.
Mm.
And as soon as he finished being Prime Minister, that is to say during the last 10 years of his life, I was on my own.
Mm. There were, you were going over there to be one of two protection officers, were you?
Mm.
Right. And so you were filling a vacancy, the previous one.
I was filling a vacancy. The previous bloke had sprained his back trying to change the place of a huge boulder. Churchill was vandalising, some would say, and reorganising. Chartwell.
Oh, I see, yes.
Chartwell and Bardock's Farm. Mm. And he was taking down fences and putting them up elsewhere, do you see, hedges
so,
and things
so
like that.
So he was helping him, he did his back in.
And yes, that's right. And
He was permanently done in by
no,
him?
No, 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 no. Yeah. What's more, he had put in an application for the Malayan Police Force.
Oh, I see.
And shortly afterwards he went to the Malayan Police Force. And now he's back. As a matter of fact, it's interesting to note that he was the brother of Rupert Davis, who used to play in the Maigret, that's
yes,
right.
On the
they were brothers.
Oh, really?
And so, but he went to the Malayan Police Force, not for a short time. We used to call him the Bish, because he really looked like a Bish. And
Bishop.
he's still about, yes.
Oh, really?
He's still about, with a little moustache. And he's still about, and somebody brought good tidings from him. Just a short while ago, I was in an official place, and I can't remember where it was, but it's beside the point. And so there, on one occasion, you know, after I'd taken over from Bish, we were out there, and we used to take out this flask of very, very weak whiskey and soda. I called it lemonade, and we used to take a bucket of ice at the time, too, and a couple of glasses, and he would invite me to partake of it, you see, while he was partaking of it. And 9 times out of 10, I used to say, no, lemonade, you know, I can have it home, sort of. But I used to smoke cigars, too, and I used to carry the 4 cigars in my pocket, available for him. And he told me, you know, if ever you want to smoke a cigar, do help yourself.
So you were taken by car to go and meet Churchill at Chartwell, right? So what described the meeting?
Well, as I got out of the car at Chartwell, there's a bit of a forecourt, and the big door, main door, was half open, and through that I could see sitting on a leather-covered bench. It's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and was this figure, and I recognised it. I mean, it was the most recognisable figure in the whole world, really, for a long time. And there was Churchill sitting on this red leather-covered bench, and he was wearing a silver Stetson, you know, 5 gallon rather than 10 gallon.
Why was he doing that?
Because he liked hats, and he liked to wear the Stetson when he, or the sombrero when he went out into the garden, right, onto the farm, as he was going to do on this particular day. It was a nice day, it was right. August, you see. And so he was smoking a cigar. He was also wearing his siren suit, which he himself had perfected during the war, which had a zip fastener, you know, right from the groin right up to the top. And so it was very practical when he wanted to get out of it or into it. And so he'd perfected it during the war and wore, you know, and was accustomed to its use. And he had about a dozen of these. Two or three of them were velvet in Bordeaux or royal blue, which Lady Churchill occasionally permitted him to wear at an informal friend's meal, do you see. But the other ones he used when he went painting, for instance, in serge or in even lighter stuff than that. And so he liked wearing them. And occasionally, you know, when he was pulling the zip up, I would hear a roar. I got to know, and I knew then that he'd encountered difficulties pulling his zip up. And we used to laugh about it afterwards. But, you know, this sort of thing used to happen to Churchill. Well, on that particular time.
So there he was sitting there.
There he was sitting. And he sort of looked at me and offered his right. He took his cigar out of his mouth with his left hand, and he offered me his right hand, and he belched. I mean, he'd just come down from lunch, and he'd been drinking Paul Roger champagne, probably, because I don't think he ever paid for the Paul Roger champagne. Madame Paul Roger was a friend. He named a horse after her. Whether that's an advantage or not, I don't know. I can't remember it ever winning a race. But she was a frequent visitor, and he liked the champagne. And so he belched, and then he offered me his right hand, and I took it and shook it very carefully, respectfully. The while he said, "Ah, so you are Sergeant Murray." And his sort of eyes twinkling there. "I hear you've had a most interesting life. And you even paint in oils. I'm quite sure we shall have many happy years together." And how right he was. It's quite interesting to note, incidentally, that I'd only been painting in oils for about a fortnight.
But he knew.
And my wife had given me the wherewithal to paint in oils because she knew it was one of my great ambitions, to do, do you see. And so for my birthday, an early birthday present, my birthday is the 18th of August. Right. And this was the first week in August.
So what did he, the impression, if that isn't too...
Felt straight away that he was just a cuddly teddy bear, really, sitting there. And I thought that, golly, they want to... why should he be protected?
But he's about 76 or something at that time, was he?
76, and I was 33. Yeah. And so I looked at him, and, you know, the way he shook my hand was firm, but lightly. But his eyes were piercing and bright and shiny. But he looked quite doddery and, you know, quite impotent, really. And then he said, you know, right, we'll go for a drive. And the Hillman van was outside. And the valet was there sitting in the back seat, on the back seat, and he was carrying the big flask containing the lemonade and the ice and the glasses.
So this was whiskey soda, weak whiskey soda.
Very weak whiskey and soda in the flask. To keep it cool. And then so I assisted him out and assisted him into the...
August. It being August.
August.
You have to keep it cool.
Oh, the ice. Yes, of course. Yeah. Oh, yes. But there was ice also.
Yes.
You also like to have the tinkling of the ice in the glass.
Right.
And but he liked it cold, very cold. Then I assisted him into the passenger seat in the front of the Hillman Minx van. And then, of course, naturally. Yes, and so I got into the driver's seat and drove round. And so Norman was sort of guiding me. I didn't know me way about.
Norman is the valet.
Norman, right. Yes, who was ex-Navy, but he was young, and he was... I've heard, I know he's died since, but he was often quite irresponsible, really. But we had a good few jokes together, and which will probably come out in the wash later on. But in any case, there he was, and directed me left out of the front gate, and down there, and then first left to go down a very narrow lane towards, which Churchill called it, Puddle Dock Lane. Puddle Dock Lane, that was the name it went down there. And we went down there and right up the hill on the other side, a very narrow lane, to Bardog's farm, where he had pigs. And he was one of the first landowners in this country to import land-raised pigs from Scandinavia.
Right.
And they were very, very long in the back and practically fatless, you see, hardly any fat on them at all. So Christopher Soames, who was more or less his farm manager then, and eventually, of course, to become ambassador to Britain in Paris, and Lady Mary, his wife, is still going strong. But Christopher died some 10 years ago, I think.